This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Well, our protein itself is exponentially less resource intensive, the insect protein, the less land, water, almost no greenhouse gases.
In the wake of the recent U.S. election, which was beyond disappointing to those of us who care about the planet, Sea Change Radio will not be closely covering political issues and the machinations of the incoming administration simply because it will be too depressing. Instead, we'll continue to cover the shift to sustainability. Rather than focusing on humans this week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into the archives and turn our gaze to the insect world. First, we speak to two scientists, Dylan Gaeta and Scott Miller from Johns Hopkins University, who share their research on the effects that termite pesticides are having on the climate. Then we hear from Ann Carlson, the CEO of Jiminy's, who talks about the benefits of her company's insect-based dog food. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dylan Gaeta and Scott Miller. Dylan is a PhD candidate at Johns Hopkins School of Environmental Engineering, and Scott is an assistant professor there. Scott, Dylan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
So, Dylan, you're the lead on this study that is just getting published, entitled California Dominates U.S. Emissions of the Pesticide and Potent Greenhouse Gas Sulfuryl Fluoride. Explain the genesis of your research and why people should be aware of this.
I hadn't heard of sulfuryl fluoride until I came to Hopkins and started my PhD here. This was around 2020, and I started working with Scott. And so Scott had been in contact with a colleague from the NOAA Global Monitoring Laboratories, who was sort of at the end of his career and had started looking at this gas. Around 2015, NOAA Global Monitoring Laboratory started making these measurements and sort of passed it on to Scott as to say, like, well, I'm out of time to look at this myself, but maybe this would be a good topic to look into further. And so we started digging into where this gas is emitted in the world and like what it's used for, how it's been accumulating in the global atmosphere. And when we started looking at those measurements, we sort of found a sort of striking lack of information about the global distribution of this gas and where it's being used and what it's being used for and how much is being emitted in different parts of the world. And so what we did in our research study is that we used atmospheric measurements that were collected by our colleagues over at the NOAA Global Monitoring Laboratory. And we used those atmospheric measurements to sort of backtrace where the emissions of this gas were coming from. And when we did that, we found that a pretty striking majority of U.S. emissions of this gas were coming from the state of California, and we didn't see a whole lot of evidence for emissions of this gas happening outside of California, which is sort of unusual for most greenhouse gases, where you can imagine they're a little bit more, the emission sources are spread a little bit more evenly throughout where people live. But in this case, we saw a big hotspot over California, and especially Southern California.
I'll jump in and add something as well. I grew up in the state of North Dakota, which is, you know, a cold, frozen state that doesn't have too many termites running around. And I moved out to California in year 2015, about the same time that NOAA was starting to collect these measurements of sulfuryl fluoride. And when I lived out there, I had about a 7-mile commute on a bicycle to get to work every day. And I would, you know, bike through these residential neighborhoods in the San Francisco Bay Area. And see what looked like giant circus tents over the top of houses. And being from North Dakota, I had never seen that before. And my housemate at the time happened to be from Sacramento. And I was talking to her and she said, oh, you haven't seen that before? You don't know what that is? And I said, well, no, I don't. She said, you know, that's termite fumigation. And it's a pretty common thing that you see around the state of California. And you know, we just don't have that back in the state of North Dakota. And so I was talking to our colleague, Ben Miller at NOAA, and you know, he mentioned about how he had started observing this gas, sulfuryl fluoride, the primary gas that's used for termite fumigation. And I thought, huh, well, it's interesting to take a look at it because it's something we definitely see here in the state of California. see use of this gas in California, but that I hadn't ever seen before I moved here. And then lo and behold, when we, you know, dug in and look at emissions patterns and try to estimate where these emissions were coming from, all the data that we have seems to be pointing, like you might guess, at California.
Dylan, maybe you can explain how you were able to investigate and isolate this gas in your study and walk us through your research method a little bit, if you can.
It wasn't until about 2009 when sulfuryl chloride was actually identified as a long-lived greenhouse gas. So I think prior to 2009, most people had thought about this topic, had sort of assumed that sulfuryl chloride only persists in the atmosphere for a short amount of time. And so since it was presumed to be so short-lived, its global warming effect was thought to be pretty small. But one of our colleagues, Jens Mühle, who's a co-author on the study, published a paper in 2009 showing that it actually, sulfuryl chloride in the atmosphere breaks down really slowly. So it reacts really slowly with all the gases in our atmosphere that we had previously thought might scrub this from the atmosphere. And it turns out to be the ocean that takes up most of this gas. And that process of the ocean taking up sulfuryl chloride happens really slowly. And sort of with the absence of an efficient removal mechanism from the atmosphere, the gas persists after being emitted for something like 40 years in the atmosphere. And over that 40-year lifetime, since the gas is a greenhouse gas, it has the ability to trap heat and send it back down to Earth over a much longer time period. And so because of that, it has a larger global warming potential than what we originally thought when we started using the gas.
So is it the gas itself which is surprisingly harmful, or is it the fact that it's in much larger quantities than previously thought?
So it was the lifetime that sort of was the surprise. So scientists from AGAGE, the Advanced Global Atmospheric Gases Experiment, had been measuring sulfuryl chloride in our global atmosphere at different places around the world. Since I think it was around 2004 or 2003 was the first time this was measured in the air. And then the scientists also went back and took measurements of archived flask samples, air flask samples that had been stored all the way back to 1978 and had found sulfuryl chloride levels in those flasks as well, but saw this increasing trend where over the span of about 50 years from the late 70s to today, we've seen about a tenfold increase in our atmosphere. So now current concentrations are around something like 3 parts per trillion. So 3 out of every trillion air molecules in our atmosphere are sulfuryl chloride now.
Is there a direct correlation between sulfuryl chloride emissions and termite control? Can we pinpoint that specific practice as the red flag, so to speak? Or was that just another log on the fire?
So just to back up, this sulfuryl chloride is also like an entirely anthropogenically produced compound. So there's no significant natural sources of the gas.
Maybe you can walk us through the history of it. How long has it been in production and how has the EPA classified it up till now?
Yeah, so the gas was first starting to be produced by Dow Chemical, and I believe this was like the late 50s. But starting off, the quantities that were produced were relatively small because we had other replacement fumigants. We had other alternative fumigants that were used for fumigating termites and other bugs and pests that we were worried about, both within structures and also like agricultural. But it was around the late 80s, early 90s when scientists started to identify methyl bromide as one of the major contributors to the ozone depletion. And so under the Montreal Protocol, countries around the world signed an agreement to phase out the use of methyl bromide. And so in the United States, that deadline to phase out methyl bromide was around 2005. And so as methyl bromide was phased out, people started to look for alternative fumigants, and sulfuryl chloride sort of came onto the scene as the preferred effective replacement for methyl bromide. So it doesn't deplete the ozone layer, which is really what we were looking for at the time, was a fumigant gas that doesn't deplete the ozone layer. So we started using sulfuryl chloride and then sort of later found out that it's actually a pretty potent greenhouse gas. So it doesn't have the same ozone depleting effects, which is great, but it does have a contribution to planetary heating as well.
It's not easy being green. Heaven is Band-Aid stain, the color of the leaves. When it could be nicer being red, yellow or gold, or something much more colorful like that. Like that. It's not easy being green. You seem to blend in with so many ordinary everyday things. People tend to pass you by because you're not standing out like sparkles in the water, stars in the sky. But
this is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Dylan Gaeta and Scott Miller of Johns Hopkins. So, Scott, maybe you can put into context what Dylan was just telling us about the history of sulfural fluoride.
Yeah, so the gas that was previously used was called methyl bromide. And, you know, one thing Dylan highlighted is that the old gas that we used to use, methyl bromide, was an ozone-depleting substance. But not only did it deplete the ozone layer, but also had some pretty terrible health impacts as well. It's a known carcinogen. It causes cancer and was shown to cause developmental and neurological delays in children. And so this gas is certainly something that we do not want to be using anymore, methyl bromide. And so as bad as sulfural fluoride is, as a potent greenhouse gas, it does replace a chemical that was far, far worse for the environment, both for the ozone layer and for people's health.
So give us an idea of how much your study is projecting that sulfural fluoride contributes to greenhouse gas emissions and what the curbing of this and regulation of this gas could do to improve the situation, Dylan.
There's been some work through the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's characterized sulfural fluoride levels in the atmosphere. And I think the IPCC reports have, I think, done a good job of sort of putting the impact of sulfural fluoride in context with all the other greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. In terms of policy around sulfural fluoride, it's an interesting case because, unlike most of the other greenhouse gases that are included under the accounting protocols, either like it for national greenhouse gas inventories or state level greenhouse gas inventories, sulfural fluoride is not included in any of them. So if you think of sort of like landmark climate change legislation, like under the United Nations or in California, there's the California Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. These sort of policies mandate emissions reductions of greenhouse gases across the board. But in all of these cases, sulfural fluoride isn't included in that list of greenhouse gases that require emissions reductions. So in that sense, it's sort of slipping through the cracks or under the radar in our greenhouse gas emissions accounting.
So what's the solution in your mind? Is it banning sulfural fluoride, or are there ways to mitigate its effects?
Yeah, so I think there's a few options on the table that California or the U.S. or the world as a whole could consider in terms of ways to mitigate our sulfural fluoride emissions. And they don't necessarily have to be a ban or a restriction or a new phase out. So one possibility that we mention in our study, so this practice of structural fumigation, where you cover a house with an airtight tent and then pump it full of sulfural fluoride, typically after that happens, after the fumigant has wiped out all the termites, that tent is opened and vented straight to the atmosphere. And so that's the problematic practice, is that instead of recapturing all our sulfural fluoride after use, it's vented straight to the atmosphere. And so one solution that we hint at is the idea of recapturing that gas and destroying it before it can enter the atmosphere. So it's a step that could be added to the fumigation process. It's one that would likely add some cost and time to the fumigation process, but it would also save sulfural fluoride emissions from entering the atmosphere, and also, with that in mind, also save on some greenhouse gas emissions.
What are the best ways to keep track of it now that you've been getting your hands into the process of trying to measure this greenhouse gas, Dylan?
Yeah, so I think sulfural fluoride is now that it's been identified as a long-lived greenhouse gas, I think the important next step is to include sulfuryl fluoride emissions in greenhouse gas accounting protocols, like in the state of California, at the US level, and also nationally, so that we can have a handle on like how much greenhouse gas, how much of this gas is being emitted by different entities. Because until we have that information, it's harder to design policies that reduce emissions.
Scott Miller and Dylan Gaeta, thank you so much for being my guests on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks again. It's been great being here, and it's fun to chat about the science that we're working on.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been nice chatting.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by the founder and CEO of Jiminy's, Anne Carlson. Anne, welcome to SeaChange Radio.
Thank you for having me here.
So explain for our listeners what Jiminy's offers consumers and the problem you're trying to address.
Jiminy's is disrupting the pet industry. We're fighting climate change as we feed our pets. And how are we doing that? We're replacing traditional protein, so think cow or chicken, with insect and plant protein. And so we're delivering sustainable dog food that's coupled with better nutrition, no compromises.
And explain the process of sourcing insects. Where do you get your grubs and your crickets? How does that work?
Yeah, well, they come from farms. So these are all farmed indoors. And the great thing about farming insects is that it takes so much less land than any other type of protein source. And they're naturally swarming species, so they like to live together. So it's extremely humane as well. And actually, let me just give you an example. If you've got an acre of land, and say you were to put cows on that acre of land, at the end of a year, you'd have 192 pounds of protein. If you put chickens on that land, you'd have 265 pounds. If you put crickets, 65,000 pounds of protein. And if you put grubs, which is another type of insect we're working with, over 1 million pounds of protein at the end of a year.
And who do you see as being your main consumer? I would imagine the low-hanging fruit would be vegetarians and vegans who are also pet lovers, who feel torn about giving their dogs and cats animal protein when they're not buying it themselves.
Absolutely. That's definitely part of the demographic. But it's also other families that are concerned about the environment, and they might be doing meatless Mondays. So they consider themselves, say, a flexitarian. But let's always remember, though, that our end consumer is the dog. And so the other type of pet parent that's going to be buying the product is one that's got a problem. Their dog's got a gut health issue, or their dog has an allergy. And this is a fantastic solution for those types of dogs as well.
Yes, I know I have vegetarian friends who will feed their dog a vegetarian diet to go along with the people's diet. And I can't help but think that's not what dogs want to eat usually. They don't want to eat just vegetables and rice. They want higher protein levels. And so these insect solutions seem to be a good compromise for people who have those buying principles.
Absolutely. And so dogs are omnivores. So, you know, they can eat a wider range of food than, say, a cat could, who's truly a carnivore. But they're also athletes. And, you know, if you watch your dog go and catch a frisbee, you can see, like, they're amazing. But they need a higher level of protein to maintain that kind of level of activity. And the great thing about the insects is that it is a complete protein for the dogs. And that means that it has all of the essential amino acids that they need. And it does it in spades. And it's a little hard to actually get there, to get the right amino acids when you're working with plants. So that's one of the great advantages of working with the insect protein. But the insect protein, it's more complete than that. It's actually a superfood. You've got your protein, yes, but you've also got vitamins, minerals, fiber. And the fiber is that thing that actually feeds the good bacteria in the dog's gut. So it's actually prebiotic. And that's really important. Healthy gut. I'm sure you've heard a lot about healthy gut being important for humans. It's the same for dogs.
So can you give us a summary of how you got into this, the history of Jiminy's, if you will?
Sure. I've been working in the consumer packaged goods industry for my whole career. And I've been working with pet for the last 12 years. So I was at one of the big pet companies, and we got acquired. They're getting acquired all the time. The company that acquired us, though, was far away in the middle of the country. And I live in California, and I really didn't want to move. So I opted to stay here. And I started thinking about what I wanted to do next. And as I was thinking through all the different things that I could potentially do, I was talking to my daughter, who was kind of thinking about her future as well. And we got onto the topic of whether or not she might want to have kids. And she told me no. She was worried about what the world would be like by the time they grew up. And for me, that was a call to action. I decided that no matter what I did, I was going to fight climate change. And about that same time, I got approached to lead a pet food company. And what they were proposing is that it was sustainable, but it was grass-fed beef. And I loved the idea of sustainability in pet. A lot of people don't realize this, but 30% of the environmental impact of meat consumption in the U.S. is attributed to our dogs and cats.
Wow, that's a stunningly huge number.
Yeah, but you know, grass-fed beef, it's still a cow. It's never going to be the answer. So what I did with them is started to think about, well, what protein sources could work and would actually be sustainable. And that was about the time I saw a UN study that said insects could be the answer to world hunger. And so I was like, insects. So I actually ordered some dry roasted crickets online. You can actually do that.
Yeah, we have them in my closet still. My wife bought them a few years ago. We've put them in a few smoothies, but they're being eaten very slowly here.
Okay. Well, I gave them to my dogs and they got eaten really quickly. The dogs, the drool started right away. You know, the dogs just don't overthink it. If it tastes good, they're going to eat it.
Yeah, they're not overthinking a lot.
So my dogs went nuts for it, and that's basically got us started down the path.
Every time I go to town, they all kick my dog around. Every time I go to town, they all kick my dog around. Better stop kicking my dog around. Better stop kicking my dog around. I don't care if he is wrong. He don't kick my dog around.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Ann Carlson. She is the founder and CEO of Jiminy's Pet Food. So you mentioned how when you first got these crickets dry roasted in the mail, you fed them to your dogs and they loved them. But now explain the product that Jiminy's is offering that has combined grains and vegetables with the insect protein. How did you formulate it, and walk us through the range of products?
Oh, yeah. Well, at this point, we've got a broad range of products. And the way I like to think about it is we're putting together products that work for every part of your day with your dog. So we started out with treats when we were getting our feet underneath us and doing all the studies. We've got crunchy biscuits that are great when you want to reward your dog for doing something that he should be doing, like sitting back when you open the door. We've got a fantastic range of training treats, which are designed specifically for training. We worked with an animal behavior expert in order to design those treats. Under 3 calories, they can break into pieces. They're super enticing. When we palatability test our products, we're trying to get above 95 on all of our products, and we have, which is really exciting. The training treats score 100, which means every single dog that has tried them has loved them. A few more products, puffs, which are really fun. They're like Cheetos for dogs. They're human grade, so you can eat them with your dog. But one of the cool functional things about them is that they actually float. So we work with the Canine Rehabilitation Institute, and they're using it in the water treadmill. So when they're trying to rehab a dog in that water treadmill, they drop the puffs in, they float, and the dog walks to them to eat them.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I love that one. And then we also, of course, have a food. So we've got a baked kibble. And what I love about our baked kibble is, well, in terrific ingredients, using the insect protein is the only protein source. But it takes it to a much lower temperature, so less processed. And then our newest product is a wet food. We call it an entree. And it's really cool. It comes in a Tetra Pak, which is a really sustainable packaging, and it can be used as a topper with food or as a standalone meal.
So can you paint a picture of the farming process of grubs and crickets? I mean, it sounds a little creepy, to be honest, but like when they arrive to your warehouse or for factory, like what kind of state are we talking about?
Not scary at all.
No. Okay.
Grubs to us, it's a protein powder. So it's already, they've been roasted and ground. So we're working with a powder. It's almost like what you would put in your smoothies. Think of it that way.
The cooties are pre-removed before they get to the Jiminy's factory.
Totally. And actually they're not scary at all. You know, and by the time we get it, no antennas, no legs.
So I know it's apples to oranges a little bit, but give us an idea of how Jiminy's compares to a standard dog food in terms of its carbon footprint, Anne.
Well, our protein itself is exponentially less resource intensive, the insect protein, the less land, water, almost no greenhouse gases. But then beyond that, we're all based in the U.S. We source from the U.S. and Canada, so everything is North American sourced. And that's a big deal because we're not having to ship things these crazy distances. And if you look at a lot of the other companies, they're sourcing from China, they're sourcing from Australia. It's traveling immense distances to be made into an extruded kibble for your dog. It's terrible for the environment. The protein is bad. The shipping is bad. There's a lot of issues.
She's the founder and CEO of Jiminy's, Anne Carlson. Anne, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Taj Mahal, Van Morrison, and Rusty Kershaw. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.